Thank you, Your Honor. Alexander Prieto for the appellants. And I would like to reserve 4 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Can you speak up, please?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
This is Alexander Prieto for the appellants, and I would like to reserve 4 minutes of time for rebuttal. This is a case where a preliminary injunction is necessary to prevent severe irreparable harm. The denial of emergency SNAP benefits that about 1 million California, 1 million of California's poorest families need to avoid going hungry during the unprecedented pandemic that the country is now facing. Now, the first preliminary injunction factor, the likelihood of success on the merits, involves a pure question of law, a straight question of statutory interpretation that this court considers de novo. And that question really boils down to this: who did Congress intend to benefit when it wrote this statute providing emergency allotments to address temporary food needs? Did Congress intend to benefit all SNAP households, including those with the lowest incomes? Or, as USDA contends, did it intend to benefit only a subset of households, those with relatively higher incomes, while completely denying emergency aid to the lowest income households, solely because those households already receive the maximum non-emergency benefit? The statutory language is clear and unambiguous on this point and allows only one answer. Congress intended these benefits to be available to all families and all SNAP households. First, there's a phrase that Congress used to describe who it intended to provide these benefits to: households participating in the SNAP program. That phrase unambiguously includes all SNAP households without any exceptions.
Well, but the exception, as the district court's view, comes from the limiting phrase, not greater than the applicable maximum monthly allotment. And why isn't the best reading of that phrase to apply the rule of the last antecedent and say, that Congress is not creating emergency allotments not greater than the maximum. It's addressing temporary food needs not greater than the maximum. So it only applies when people have, had food needs below the maximum, they get brought up to their temporary need, up to the maximum.
Well, the phrase temporary food needs and the context of an emergency shows that the needs Congress is addressing are necessarily needs above and beyond the needs addressed by the regular SNAP benefit. So if you apply the rule of the last antecedent and say, okay, this statute is concerned with temporary food needs, and the measure of those temporary food needs is that they cannot be greater than the maximum regular allotment, the value of those food needs is the up to the full amount of the maximum allotment. It's not the difference between the maximum allotment and the amount the household receives. That's the phrase, that's the quantity that USDA is actually saying the limiting phrase applies to. But that phrase never appears in the statute, so the limiting phrase cannot apply to that quantity.
Either but why,
it applies what, to the emergency.
I'm not sure I understand that, because why? It seems like and I take your point that we don't have this phrase elsewhere to draw on other meanings of it, but it seems like, just thinking about what that phrase could mean, like a permissible understanding of it, to say, normally I need X, but I have a temporary need for some amount that is greater than X. And, what Congress is saying here under the government's reading is, we're addressing temporary needs, but only up to the maximum. So you're suggesting that the word temporary, the temporary need is only the increase, but it seems permissible to read it as the temporary need is, you know, your need during this temporary period, you know, your total need during the temporary period. Why isn't that permissible?
The temporary need I think just take a step back. We need to understand that the amount that SNAP normally provides to all households is the same amount. Every household receives an amount that is sufficient to bring that household up to the maximum allotment for that household size. Whether it's strict for the lowest income families, they get that amount strictly through the SNAP benefit. When it is for someone with higher income, they get that amount through a combination of their imputed contribution and the SNAP benefit that they receive. But everyone is raised to the same baseline level by regular SNAP benefits. Therefore, a temporary need during an emergency is necessarily something that gives a family an increase above that baseline level. So under the government's interpretation,
Counsel. I did not understand that answer. Everybody is brought up, regardless of their income or contribution, the same amount.
Yes. The reason I say that is because there's a maximum regular SNAP benefit.
Right. Maximum.
Yes. A maximum regular amount.
Less than the maximum. Correct?
People get less than the maximum because the income available to them plus the benefit that they get equals the maximum.
Okay.
So everyone is raised to that same baseline maximum, whether it's through their own funds combined with SNAP or with just the SNAP benefit.
Well, everybody doesn't get the same amount of SNAP benefit.
No, they don't.
Okay.
But they're all considered to have the same
need.
They're all considered to need the same amount in order to purchase food. And the SNAP benefits raise everybody to that same amount. So temporary food need is necessarily something that is above that baseline.
Well, you'd be better off if they had used the word all before the phrase households participating in SNAP, but they didn't use that word.
They didn't use all households participating in SNAP, no, but at the same time, they didn't include any exceptions to that. They didn't say households participating in SNAP except for those receiving the maximum regular benefit. And they didn't use any language that distinguishes between households based on the amount of their regular SNAP benefit or based on their income. The statute never refers to any of those characteristics. So excluding people from receiving the benefit based on those characteristics essentially adding an exception to the statute that Congress didn't write.
Well, you're adding an exception to the statute that Congress didn't write, aren't you? You're inserting all in order to make your argument flow.
The argument doesn't require all. It simply looks at what Congress said about the households who are eligible and looks at did it put any exceptions on those households? And the answer is no.
Could Could you address the government's argument based on the CARES Act? I mean, because that's we have this other statute passed just a few days later, and the government says that the amount of money appropriated there sort of makes sense in terms of its understanding of how this is supposed to work, but would be seriously inadequate under your understanding of how it's supposed to work. And so that enactment suggests that Congress had in mind USDA's view. What's your answer to that?
Yes, USDA's argument is based solely on its evidence that it presented that a member that USDA provided some estimate of what it thought its interpretation would cost to a member of congressional staff. USDA hasn't presented any evidence that estimate was ever brought before Congress, say in a committee report, and it hasn't presented any evidence that evidence was in fact ever brought to the attention of any member of Congress. And the cases are clear that a communication to a congressional staff that never makes it to Congress is not considered legislative history. It's not something that could have had any influence on a congressional vote, so it can't be used to interpret a statute.
Why? I mean, the provision of the appropriation refers to it says to be allocated as the secretary deems necessary should cost or participation exceed budget estimates, which does suggest a certain level of attentiveness on the part of Congress to what the USDA's cost estimates are, doesn't it?
But there's no evidence that Congress was aware of USDA's cost estimates, and that phrase, when it's talking about cost estimates, it's not just talking about estimates for these emergency allotments, because that appropriation was also for regular SNAP benefits. So that's also referring to the estimates of regular SNAP benefits, which were known.
You're down to about 2 minutes, 30 seconds. Do you want to reserve?
Yes, I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Handel?
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Josh Handel from the United States Department of Agriculture.
Mr. Handel, I cannot hear you.
All right, I'm sorry. I'll try to speak up, Judge. Can you hear me a little
bit
better
now? Microphone.
Here we go. How about that?
Better.
All right. As broad segments of the national economy were shutting down at the outset of the pandemic, Congress gave USDA flexibility to adjust certain income reporting requirements and to otherwise address temporary food needs under the statutory cap on monthly benefits for SNAP households in states where both federal and state disaster declarations had issued. USDA approached that scenario the same way it has when other disasters have brought local and state economies to a sudden halt, by temporarily providing every SNAP household with the full cost of the Thrifty Food Plan for its household size without enforcing the standard 30% net income offset. USDA then communicated that approach to Congress, which promptly appropriated an amount consistent with the agency's interpretation of the statute. So at a bare minimum, USDA's reading of Section 2302 reflects a reasonable interpretation of the statutory language that is consistent with longstanding agency practice and with Congress's appropriation in the companion bill enacted 9 days later. Plaintiffs.
So where is that in the record?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, which part of that?
No, the communication to Congress.
Oh, sure. So I believe we discussed that in our summary judgment briefing below. I believe it was in one of the declarations. Candidly, Your Honor, we went into greater detail about this in the district court proceedings in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, because the Judge Young in those proceedings had asked for a little bit more information and detail on the iterative process between USDA and the Congressional Committee. I do not recall whether any of those supplemental declarations made it into the record below as part of the summary judgment briefing. I know they did not make it in as part of this appeal because obviously this appeal moved very quickly after Judge Gilliam had issued the order denying the preliminary injunction.
Even if it's in a declaration, I mean, that's an unusual sort of legislative history, isn't it? I mean, we don't have anything in a committee report or sort of any formal statement from Congress or anything other than, you know, someone at USDA saying, you know, this is what I told some member of a congressional staff. I mean, that we don't normally rely on that sort of thing in interpreting a statute, do we?
No, you don't, Judge Miller. You're absolutely right. I would point out that these coronavirus relief acts did not follow the typical course for legislation. There was not extensive committee debate and hearings and reports and things like that. I mean, you had the Families First Act that was enacted on March 18th, 2020, and the CARES Act, the companion piece of legislation that was enacted 9 days later. So you're right that what we normally look to as kind of the formal indicia of legislative history are somewhat sparse in this situation where you were dealing with Congress responding to a crisis scenario.
So there's no indication really in the record. And it's not really your fault given the emergency situation in Congress, even if it were aware of the amount, really was aware of the assumptions that you might make as asserted in this case. And I say that because I'm familiar with the judiciary's response to congressional requests. The CARES Act, we just had come up with the estimates on a very, very quick basis. I guess my point is, I'm not sure how much weight we can put on it. And I share perhaps Judge Miller's concern that if we get down in the weeds of who said what to a committee member, that's where we're altering our analysis of legislative history.
So Chief Judge Thomas, I completely understand that concern. I don't want to kind of get out over my skis in terms of what's reflected in the record. I can represent to the court that alongside the cost estimate that USDA sent to OMB and that OMB then sent to committee staff, there was also a brief explanation of USDA's approach that reflected its topping off interpretation of Section 2302. But again, because nothing like that was submitted alongside our briefs in this case, and because, you know, even taking that email as a given, we can't point to a certain piece of evidence that approach was then communicated to an actual member of Congress. I don't want to, you know, overpromise on that front.
I'm not faulting you for that. I'm just trying to clarify where we are. Can you tell me what the status of the Gilliam litigation is?
Absolutely. So Judge Young in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania entered an order granting the plaintiff's motion for a preliminary injunction that covered Pennsylvania's requests for emergency allotments. USDA then, that was on September 11th, I believe. Shortly thereafter, USDA filed a motion for a stay pending appeal and also a motion for clarification because Pennsylvania came in with a request not only for enhanced emergency allotments going forward, starting with the month of October, but also for retroactive allotments back to the enactment of the Families First Act in March. And the retroactive allotments piece of that alone would have come to, I believe, almost $500 million, which would rapidly deplete USDA's remaining fiscal year 2020 funding for any sort of SNAP allotments, emergency or otherwise. So we're in the process of first clarifying in the district court what the scope of the preliminary injunction is, and then appealing both a stay and then the actual merits of the preliminary injunction order to the Third Circuit.
So if I understand the import of Gilliam here, it only affects Pennsylvania, so it's not a nationwide injunction. Two, you haven't appealed yet, but you plan to appeal that decision. Is that right?
Both of those are correct, yes.
Yeah, so Gilliam, at best, is persuasive authority, not binding authority on anyone, right?
That's absolutely right. And, you know, we have a number of reasons that we don't consider it all that persuasive, but certainly you are not bound by what Judge Young found in Gilliam. Okay. And I do want to get...
Was Pennsylvania a party to that litigation?
They were not, Your Honor. But I do want to, you know, kind of start with the plain text of this statute, because I think we have very strong arguments just on the language. And applying standard grammatical rules and interpretive canons to the language here, as Judge Gilliam did below, the best reading of Section 2302 is a direction to USDA to address, quote, temporary food needs not greater than the applicable maximum monthly allotment for the household size, end quote. And that reading then raises the question of what qualifies as a temporary food need, because as I believe my friend acknowledged, Section 2302 of the Families First Act does not define that term. And to answer that question, I think we have to look to where Congress has set out its determination of household food needs in the statutory framework underlying the SNAP program, which brings us directly to the Thrifty Food Plan provision, 7 U.S.C. Section 2012U, where Congress established the Thrifty Food Plan as the statutory definition of the cost of the diet required to feed a family for 1 month. And that figure is the North Star of the SNAP program. Among other things, it serves as the amount to which all SNAP households are raised through supplemental allotments during natural disaster scenarios. And it defines the ceiling on food needs and thus the maximum monthly allotment for every household in the contiguous 48 states and the District of Columbia, notwithstanding pronounced real-world differences in food costs, availability, and general cost of living between those areas. So under the Food and Nutrition Act, every household in the contiguous 48 states and DC has a standard presumed food need equal to the cost of the Thrifty Food Plan minus 30% of the household's net income. And when Congress instructed the secretary to address temporary food needs that could be up to the full maximum monthly allotment, or in other words, up to the full cost of the Thrifty Food Plan, he reasonably understood Congress to be authorizing him to temporarily bring every SNAP household up to the full cost of the Thrifty Food Plan through emergency allotments, as USDA does in other disaster settings. Now, plaintiffs contend that this court should ignore all of that underlying programmatic framework and instead read Section 2302 as an across-the-board boost in every SNAP household's benefits. But when Congress wants to enact a temporary across-the-board increase in SNAP benefits, it does so by explicitly targeting the Thrifty Food Plan amount. That's what Congress did in the Recovery Act of 2009, which instructed USDA to temporarily calculate monthly SNAP benefits for all households using 113.6% of the Thrifty Food Plan. And earlier this year, the House of Representatives attempted to do the same in its third COVID-19 relief bill, the HEROES Act, which would have temporarily increased the value of SNAP benefits for all SNAP households to 115% of the value of the Thrifty Food Plan. Tellingly, Congress did not do that in the Families First Act. It didn't touch the Thrifty Food Plan. It didn't touch the maximum monthly allotment. As Judge Gilliam noted in denying a preliminary injunction, Section 2302 referenced those familiar statutory terms, but did not raise their amounts. And that's not to say that Congress couldn't have taken a novel approach and provided monthly benefits that surpassed the maximum monthly allotment without appending a multiplier to the Thrifty Food Plan, as it always has in the past. But if that's what Congress had been aiming at, there is a very straightforward way to do so. They could have just moved the not greater than language so that it immediately followed and modified emergency allotments rather than temporary food needs. In other words, the statute would direct the secretary to provide emergency allotments not greater than the applicable maximum monthly allotment for the household size to households participating in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And in that case, there would be very little doubt that Congress wanted to make the emergency allotments themselves equivalent to the maximum monthly allotment. But Congress didn't write that statute. Instead, it tethered households' temporary food needs to the maximum monthly allotment while keeping fixed the statutory definition of a household's standard presumed food needs, which is the cost of the Thrifty Food Plan minus 30% of net household income. So USDA reasonably understood that in light of pandemic-related economic disruption, households could have temporary food needs up to the full cost of the Thrifty Food Plan because they are unable to cover their standard personal income contribution.
So your reading has the result that, the as your friend on the other side pointed out, that the people who are worst off get nothing. But why is that a sensible... Why is that a sensible way to read the statute, and why would Congress have wanted to do that?
Sure. So I absolutely understand that concern, Your Honor. I think that a couple of points on that. First of all, that's the same way that the disaster supplemental SNAP benefits operate under the normal course of USDA practice. So. You know, USDA uses supplemental allotments under its emergency response authority to raise all SNAP households affected by a federally declared natural disaster up to the full cost of the Thrifty Food Plan without kind of individualized consideration of their ability to continue contributing the personal income share. And just like here, households affected by a disaster that were already receiving the full cost of the Thrifty Food Plan before the disaster do not get a boost because their statutorily presumed food need is unchanged and they do not have temporary food needs caused by disaster-related economic disruption. And I think it's also helpful to, you know, perhaps kind of put ourselves back in the mindset of where Congress was in March and recall that the Families First Act was not primarily a poverty relief bill. It was designed to maintain, to the extent possible, the status quo of household financial resources while we paused the economy to grapple with the pandemic. So,
where do you get that in the legislative history?
I'm sorry, Chief Justice.
Where do you get that in the legislative history?
So the legislative history here is very sparse. I would just point to the surrounding provisions. I would point to the other section of 2302, which is entirely concerned with people who are rapidly losing income and are finding it difficult to report that sudden diminution in household resources to a state agency. And Congress was specifically concerned with them. Congress was specifically concerned with people who were suddenly joining the ranks of the unemployed in Section 2301. This was, I think, looking at Section 2302 in the context of its surrounding provisions within the Families First Act makes clear that Congress was trying to do income stabilization here more than any sort of general poverty relief.
I think the problem with that argument is that it's not contained in the text of 2302A. And at least as I read your brief, you're saying really that was the intent of that section and not temporary food needs. So the argument would be that you're inserting something into that provision that doesn't exist.
Well, Your Honor, I think this statute is about USDA sending money to households, right? This is not one of the programs where USDA just directly kind of literally delivers baskets of food. So both sides are talking about money for household food budgets, and it's just a question of what that money is going to deal with, whether that money is trying to deal with systemic kind of food supply related issues as plaintiffs have contended, or whether that money is trying to ameliorate sudden diminutions in household income from pandemic related shutdowns as USDA contends. And I think that I take your point that we don't have a tremendously robust legislative history to rely on here, but even if this court determines that the statutory language is susceptible to both constructions, to both plaintiffs' understanding of what Congress was doing and USDA's understanding of what Congress was doing. In this posture, USDA prevails because plaintiffs have not shown that theirs is the unambiguously correct interpretation so as to justify a mandatory injunction that would upend the status quo at this preliminary stage. I see that my time has expired, so unless there are further questions, I respectfully request you affirm. Thank you.
Further questions? Okay. Rebuttal?
Yes. briefly address the, in this argument and throughout its brief, USDA relies on the saying that that Congress essentially intended these emergency allotments to function similarly to the benefits that that it provides under a different statute in a different type of disaster setting. There's no basis for that because this statute never refers to those benefits or that statute or that process. Further, there's no indication that Congress was even aware of those administrative practices of USDA, which are not contained in a regulation after notice and comment. That's not the sort of the thing that courts typically presume an agency to be aware of. And even if Congress was aware of the disaster relief administrative practices under this different statute, it used different terms than the terms used in USDA's administrative guidance. If it wanted the same thing, it would have used the same term. The term there is supplements. The term here is emergency allotments. USDA's argument really is based, it turns entirely on this claim that this statute was solely intended to focus on people who had lost income. But that's not the phrase. The phrase is temporary food needs, not temporary loss of income. And at the time that this statute was enacted in the early days of the pandemic, it was Congress didn't know exactly how COVID-19 would affect food needs. But it was clear that something serious was happening that could have profound and possibly unpredictable impacts on folks' needs for food. That's why Congress set up a statute allowing a process for those needs to be evaluated based on data submitted by the states. USDA's approach completely reads that out of the statute and instead tries to substitute a one-size-fits-all approach based on its presumption that this is only about lost income, which is not supported by the statute. The council pointed to said greater detail was submitted on the appropriations in the Gilliam case. The court there found no evidence that the estimate had any influence on the interpretation of Section 2302A. And I see my time is out, so I'll take any further questions if you have them.
I think any further questions?
No.
Well, thank you for your argument. Thank you both for your arguments. I know we didn't get through the many issues that are raised in the briefs, but I can assure you we've read them and studied them in some detail. So thank you for your succinct presentation of your positions. The case just argued will be submitted for decision, and we will be in recess for the morning.
Thank you.